me in. Shibba, shibba. I want to be closer to you. Shibba, shibba. Open up your soul. Shibba, shibba. Let me find that part of you. The part that nobody ever knew.
Let me touch your.
Hello and welcome to Let Me Touch Your Mind, the show where we try to get you to be something, do something, experience something, enjoy something. And on this day of service, there's so much to enjoy coming up. If you're looking for something to do today, the Museum of African Diaspora is celebrating today's observance of Martin Luther King's birthday as a day of service, providing free admission to the museum and programs throughout the day. They're open today till 5 o'clock. They're at 685 Mission Street at 3rd, if that's something you feel like doing today. And if there's stuff you want to do later in the week, like maybe go to a noir festival, well, I have just the person to do it for you. The very lovely, the very adorable, the very talented, the very gifted, Mr. Eddie Muller. Hello.
Hello, Marilyn. I always love getting an introduction from you. It makes my day.
How are you today, as a matter of fact?
I'm good. I thank you very much for having me on the show today.
Oh, I appreciate you being on the show.
Special day. I appreciate it. It's a privilege and an honor.
Oh, it's a privilege to have you. But it's a privilege to talk about noir. You've been doing this for how long now?
Oh, my God, I've kind of lost track.
Oh, okay.
It's over 25 years.
Yikes, wow.
Over 25 years.
And
total, in the Bay Area here, it's 21.
Okay.
It'll be the 21st year I've been presenting specifically the Noir City Film Festival here in the Bay Area.
And
so it's been a while.
It's been a while, and it's gone through some changes. I know that now you're across the bridge.
Correct, yes. For 18 of those years, we were at the Castro Theater in San Francisco, but I'm sure a lot of your listeners are aware that there's been some, you know, imbroglio, shall we say,
mm-hmm.
at the Castro Theater in regards to its future as a movie house.
Mm-hmm.
And so given this upheaval, I just wanted to have some sort of sense of continuity in my festival, so mm-hmm. Before it became impossible to go back into the Castro, I kind of made the decision to shift over to the Grand Lake Theater
mm-hmm.
in Oakland. And, you know, I live on that side. I'm a native San Franciscan, but I live on the East Bay side
mm-hmm.
these
mm-hmm.
days.
Mm-hmm.
So it's certainly much more convenient for me.
Yeah.
But also, the Grand Lake is also a fantastic movie palace that has no plans to be anything but a movie palace.
Well, yay.
So I'm happy to be there.
All right, well, let's talk about this year's festival, which is just around the corner, because I have several friends who are always like, so Marilyn, are you going? And da, 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 da. And so for our listening audience who's not familiar with the festival and when it starts and all of that, when and what's the, is there a theme this year, or is it just great
yes,
music?
There's always a theme. I learned early on that it wasn't enough that it was just film noir, that was the idea behind the festival. So you're always going to get something that's noir.
Mm-hmm.
But I like to be more specific and sort of have interesting sub-themes, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, you're right. It's just around the corner. I'm holding my breath. We start Friday.
Uh-huh.
Very excited about it. The theme this year is Darkness Has No Borders.
Ooh.
And I have done a couple of times in the past, I have done festivals that are primarily international
mm-hmm.
film
I've seen
festivals.
Those. Yeah.
Because whereas most people think of film noir, which as we've discussed in the past, is sort of crime movies, very stylish crime movies from the mid-20th century,
mm-hmm.
primarily the 1940s and 50s. And when I first got into this and started learning about it, I assumed it was all Hollywood product, that all these films at that time were being made in Hollywood, and that the film noir movement, as I call it,
mm-hmm.
Was really the epicenter for that was in Hollywood. But after 25 years, I've learned that this was kind of happening all over the world. So this year, the theme of the festival, as I said, darkness has no borders, and the idea is I'm going to show, and all my programs are double bills, so you get two movies for the price of one ticket.
Okay.
And the first movie will be an English language film, and then the complementary film following it is a foreign language film, but they have the same themes. They're complementary.
Oh.
Like they might be two heist movies or two movies, you know, like that with a plot like The Postman Always Rings Twice or something like that.
That's
so just
cool.
Just to show, I think my reasoning for this, Marilyn, was that I wanted to show that culturally around the world, these different cultures have more in common than they have to separate them. And it's interesting to look at it like, well, here are noir stories about desperate people doing mm-hmm. desperate things.
Mm-hmm.
But what is it that makes you desperate in Egypt or in Germany or
right.
in Ireland or in Argentina as compared to what makes a desperate story in the United States? That was my idea for this festival.
Well, it seems like when you think about it, every country has a corrupt underbelly that can be explored.
Precisely. That's exactly it. So, yeah, we have a film from and it's really interesting when there's that cross-pollination, because like on our opening night, the film is from Argentina. It's called Never Open That Door. No mm-hmm. abras nunca esa puerta.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a suspense film, but it's based on stories by an American suspense writer, Cornell Woolrich.
Okay.
But it was made in Argentina, and it's in 1952, and it's completely the equal of anything produced in Hollywood at that time. In some respects, it's even more spectacular in terms of the cinematography and production design. But I just love doing that. And then I'm showing it with another film written by Cornell Woolrich that was produced, you know, in Hollywood, on Hollywood sets. And
mm-hmm.
it's very interesting just to compare them and say, well, you know, there really isn't that much difference. But culturally, what are they emphasizing in these films that make them different?
Well, what did they, like, what is there kind of a theme that runs throughout, say, European film, or is it very country specific? And if so, like, what were some of the themes that you saw emerging in different countries?
Well, it's interesting. The European films, of course, are far less prudish than the American
sure.
version, because there really wasn't a production code like mm-hmm. there was in Hollywood dictating what you could and could not show.
Mm-hmm.
So French films and Italian films, for example, tend to be a little more adult in their themes and deal with, dare I say, deal with those things in a somewhat more mature manner
okay.
than the American films. But it's also really fascinating to see when a filmmaker will use a genre story, like a suspense film, like Cairo Station, which is an Egyptian film that was made in the late 50s.
Uh-huh.
And although it has a thriller structure, it is really a film that explores the different stratas of society in Egypt, and they're all kind of visible in this one train depot where the movie takes place. And it was a very, very provocative film for its time when it was released in Egypt, because there weren't films that dealt with, you know, mental illness and sexual obsession and all this kind of stuff, which is the spine of the movie, but it's everything else that goes on in the film that is kind of eye-opening, I think, for an American audience.
So you talk about Cairo Station, you said mental illness, and you've piqued my interest, but I don't really know what the movie's about.
Well, it's about a news vendor, kind of a poor, pitiful news vendor who gets an obsession with a woman who runs the lemonade stand
okay.
in Cairo Station. And what was very interesting is that the character of this guy was so controversial for the time, because as you know, noir films, one of the things that is very representative of a noir film is that the quote-unquote villain, if you will,
mm-hmm.
or the disturbed person, or, you know, the slightly off character, the desperate one, is the protagonist of the film,
mm.
which is what distinguishes noir in a lot of ways from a garden variety drama or even a crime film where, like, the detective or the cops are the protagonist. So this character was so provocative for the time that no Egyptian actor would play the role. So the director, Youssef Shahin, had to do it himself. So he plays the lead as well as co-write the screenplay and direct the film.
Wow.
And it was extremely controversial at the time. And so for like 5 years, it was actually banned in Egypt. But it has gone on to become probably the most well-known Egyptian film of that time.
Wow.
Because it was so far ahead of the curve. And we're doing that with a lot of films in this series. There's a very popular movie from Mexico called Victims of Sin, Victims del Pecado, with the great Ninon Sevilla. And she's just the most radiant and charismatic performer. And same kind of thing. Through this very pulpy, melodramatic crime story, where she plays like a cabaret singer who adopts a baby that somebody has thrown in the trash. And she, like, battles her pimp and all this stuff.
Wow. It's
very proto-feminist in a way. You're seeing all these different aspects of Mexican, the underbelly, if you will, of Mexican culture in the early 1950s. And, you know, Ninon Sevilla is just one of the most charismatic performers of all time. And she just isn't that well known in this country. So it's really a delight that we're able to show a new restoration of that film, which is so like the Never Open That Door from Argentina is a new restoration. Victims of Sin is a new restoration. And we just go down, you know, it's like a tour of the world through like danger and desire and desperation, right? We've got French films and film from South Korea, film from Japan, films from Italy, from France. It's pretty exciting. It's a really fun mix of titles.
Now, when I went, I forget how many years ago it was that you did the international one, and you had noir films, and it was post-World War II noir, which was really quite stunning, because you had a film that was from Japan, you had them from all over the place, but it was amazing how it seems that other countries had sort of, I don't want to say like they had already had a history of understanding that corruption, and so they really, I guess I want to say they really went all in on some of these movies. And so with the movies that you have now, is there one where they went really in where you're like, wow, they're more noir than noir?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I mean, you're touching on a really, really significant aspect of cinema at this time in the mid-20th century. Because And that's what's interesting, because Hollywood was the film capital of the world. And when, you know, you grow up in this country, you have a very ethnocentric view of everything. So it's like, well, we make the best films in the world, and we're the center of everything. But when it comes to noir, the way that was depicted in Hollywood films was, wow, what a crisis. You know, our soldiers went overseas and fought and saved the world for democracy and freedom. And then they come home and they're alienated and they can't fit in and all this stuff. And you think, wow, that was a serious aspect of what these movies were about. But then you realize that the American soldiers were coming home to a country that hadn't been bombed.
Right.
Whereas in Italy and Germany, in England, in Japan, these were countries that had been devastated by the war.
Right.
And so those post-World War II noir films are astounding documents of that time. And in fact, they've earned the distinction of being called rubble films.
Ooh.
Because that's where they were shot. You know, in America, the big deal was they shot Naked City in New York in 1947. And it was like, wow, a film shot on location. That's a big deal. Well, when they were shooting those films on location in Italy and in Germany, they were rubble films because the cities were in ruins. So yes, that makes for stories that are much, you know, much darker and filled with much more existential dread.
Yes.
Than the American variety. In particular, there's a film that we're showing called Aimless Bullet from South Korea.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that was its own thing. The war, the Korean War, was its own thing in the 1950s, and the separation of Korea into North and South. This film made in South Korea was the ultimate example of like a post-war film where your country has been devastated.
Mm-hmm.
And like, how do you go on? I know I'm making it sound like it must be a very despairing thing, and it is, but that's the thing about film noir, it's done with such style.
Yes, panache.
And because it's a genre film about a guy trying to keep his family together while he has a very severe toothache, which becomes very symbolic of the whole thing.
Like, okay.
The sacrifice this guy makes because he can't afford to get his tooth extracted. But it is, you know, just like I was saying about Cairo Station, Aimless Bullet is a film that was so controversial when it first came out in South Korea because it was showing the Koreans a view of their culture that the government didn't really want them to see.
Sure.
Right? It was being very, very honest about the desperation that a lot of people felt. And so, again, it was like, the government was kind of cracking down on it. And interestingly, it was only years later, right here in San Francisco, when the film kind of leaked out of South Korea, and it was at the San Francisco International Film Festival where It was first shown outside of Korea, and made like a it was a revelation to people, like, wow, look at what they're doing there. And you know, now South Korean films, you know, have evolved into being one of the leading film cultures in the world. But
This
film was the one that sort of started it.
Well, you talk about the Korean government not wanting that view of their country and the Hays Code. They were all up in arms about sex and everything. But in the noir genre in the United States, was there ever any pushback from the government, or did they just look at it as, oh, they're just crime films, we don't care?
Well, that's an interesting point because yeah, I mean, that became a really big deal in Hollywood because the government, it wasn't specifically that they were saying you can't show this or you can't show that, but they were using the people whose work was critical of the status quo in the United States, or critical of, you know, the spread between the haves and the have-nots and things like that, which is a big running theme in crime films.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
If you can't earn what you want, you're going to steal what you want.
Right.
And it became a hot button in with the government when the anti-communist witch hunt,
the Red Scare,
was spawned. And they said, we want to root out filmmakers like that from Hollywood. And so it's, you know, you see this happening today, just, you know, the same way, exact same way. History is repeating itself.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, if you're critical, then you're the enemy.
Right.
And it's like, well, wait a second. We're just making an artistic observation about things. It's not like we have to go to jail for this. But in fact, you know, as you well know, many, many writers and actors and producers did go to jail in this country. But it wasn't because they said, you know, your film is terrible. It was like they said, we suspect you are a subversive.
Right, right.
And they went to jail technically not for that, but because they refused to name names when they were called before Congress and said, you know, are you now or have you ever been a member of the Communist Party?
Right.
And if you refuse to answer the question on the grounds that it's a free country and you can belong to any political party you want, Then they were held in contempt of Congress and jailed.
Yeah, there's a great book called The Red Scare. It's out of print now, but it's interviews with all of these people up and down the spectrum. And among some of the interviews are interviews with people who got blacklisted from Hollywood, and also people who who talked and who were like, I had a right to say it. And other people were like, you know, they didn't have a right to ask. It's a fascinating book. I wish it were still in print. But to get back
well,
to...
Well, there are a number of really, really good books on this subject. I mean, I'm sitting in my office at home now, and I have just a section of my bookshelf that's just about this, right?
Ooh.
And I'm actually in the process of making a documentary film that touches on this area as well, because it's about an artist who was affected by the blacklist, but who went on to have a successful, if somewhat anonymous, career as a writer. And I thought it was a good time. His name's Abraham Polonsky,
mm-hmm.
and it's a really good time to discuss this again, because you see the same motivations that compelled people to do stupid stuff back then.
Mm-hmm.
It's all right here in our face again, right?
Stupidity transcends time.
A label, like, they're a threat because they believe this. Mm-hmm. And in fact, it's just score settling. You know, there was so much anti-Semitism involved mm-hmm. in the witch hunt as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, we think the Jews run Hollywood, and, you know, we got to take care of that. We got to fix that somehow. So just the catch-all was everybody was considered a communist.
Right.
You know, if you didn't agree, or you were in the way, or you were inconvenient or something, just call them a communist and you can put them out of work.
Right, right. So in this lineup of films that you have, are there any directors or writers who were just sort of under the radar, or who were affected by the Red Scare?
Interesting. I mean, yeah, there's a few. I mean, because so many of the films are foreign in this festival.
Sure.
There's less than normal, quite honestly, because if you're drawing from Hollywood films of that era, virtually every film. It's funny, Marilyn. You know, I have this show I do now on Turner Classic Movies. Every weekend I show noir films, and because everything I'm showing is basically from like 1946 to 1956.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is really the period in which the Red Scare was happening, and you had all this anti-communist hysteria and the McCarthy hearings and all this stuff. And so invariably I am going to talk about this subject
mm-hmm.
because all the people that are in the films, wrote the films, directed the films, they were all affected.
Yes.
So it's a big part of the history of that time.
Mm-hmm.
People who don't understand that, I get a lot of emails and letters saying, is it possible for you to talk about a film without mentioning the blacklist? And,
right.
and to me, that's just funny, because it just shows, you know, this lack of understanding that if you're talking about Hollywood between those years,
mm-hmm.
you have to talk about the blacklist, because
right.
it is the single most pervasive thing that affected everybody and everything in Hollywood during that time. So to ignore it is kind of the stupid way to go.
Like, right. Like, oh, we can't mention that it's a black and white film. It's like, okay.
Exactly. Because then you're going to run into that embarrassing moment where somebody says, oh, why didn't that guy make more movies? And you say, because he was blacklisted. And they say, oh, you have to bring up the blacklist.
Right. Can't you just keep it on nice things?
Exactly.
Well, I want to get back to the wide list of movies, because I'm just going to throw in that the movies over here, they're people who are blacklisted. But then so far, the two of the films, the foreign films that you've mentioned, were banned. So it seems like it's going on in different iterations in other countries.
Yeah, exactly. And there's, you know, fascinating stories amongst all of this stuff. The cross-cultural influences are amazing to me. We're showing two movies by a man from Argentina named Hugo Fregonese is mm-hmm. the director's name. And we're showing a movie called Hardly a Criminal that he made in Argentina in 1949,
mm-hmm.
which my Film Noir Foundation preserved. Several years ago, so that we could get we got the only existing materials out of Argentina, and were able to copy them.
Wow.
And subtitle them in English so we could show the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's also the director of a film we're showing called Black Tuesday, which is a very rare, has only been unearthed recently. And that's a Hollywood film, because he came to Hollywood. He kind of apprenticed in the studios in the 1940s, and then he went back to Argentina and got work making films. And then the films were so good and so clearly inspired by Hollywood movies that he came to Hollywood and started working and had a long and very successful career in Hollywood, you know, for like 14 or 15 years, and then went back to Argentina again. So he was kind of, you know, bicultural in that respect. And, you know, so that's really fun. And there's a great movie I'm showing on the last day of the festival that I just discovered about 6 months ago called Smog, which is an Italian film shot in Los Angeles with a very well-known Hollywood cinematographer. But it's a very, very Italian film. It's about it's actually about Italians coming to America and trying to assimilate into the culture and what it means to become a successful American. And it's a fantastic movie. It's very surreal. It's almost at times like a David Lynch movie. And it's in black and white, and I just loved this movie when I saw it. And I'm just so thrilled that it was restored, another new restoration, by the UCLA Film and Television Archive. I had nothing to do with it. I mean, I do a lot of restorations with them, but this was not one of them. I just learned about this film.
Yeah,
and so it is so terrific, and I'm thrilled that they're letting me show it up here before they show it themselves in Los Angeles, because I just was so knocked out by this film. I begged them to show it, and they agreed, so I'm happy.
Awesome. So that leads me to my next question, which is, because you've been doing this for so long, how do new films come across your desk? Do people go, oh, hey, Eddie, we've just found this? Or does some organization call you up and say, we've got this thing? How does that happen, that you get new stuff?
Yeah, over the years, you know, I've established a network of people around the world who share the same enthusiasms and things that I have. And it's interesting. It's not that vast a group of people. And we all cooperate. It used to be that people were a little territorial and competitive about things. Like, I found this movie and this is going to be my discovery and I'm not going to share this with anybody else. You know, like, film festival programmers can definitely get like that. Like, I want everybody to know this was my discovery. But I think in this century, we realize, with things changing so fast and with the transition from film to digital and the influence of the internet and now streaming, things travel so fast and the world has shrunk so considerably. Because I can have contacts with people in Italy and in Korea and Japan and all that I never would have been in daily contact with 25 years ago. So that's really how it works. And yes, there are archivists that you learn of and who are capable of doing these kinds of things. And then you always say, we should work together. We should work together. And let me know what you find. If you find something, you know, maybe I can come up with the money to restore it. Or if somebody comes up with something and it's not exactly in their wheelhouse, like a film noir, they would contact me and say, hey, you know, I discovered this great Portuguese film or something. And it's like, but it's kind of noir. You might be interested. And if I come across something else, you know, I'd say, this is not what we would restore, but I saw it, I loved it, I think maybe you should take care of this.
Got it. All right, I noticed that as part of the lineup you have Elevator to the Gallows, which is, I have the soundtrack to that because Miles Davis did the soundtrack to it, and he like watched it once and then just sort of kind of riffed. But can you talk a little bit about that movie?
Yeah, it's a fantastic film that it was made in 1958 in France. Jean Moreau is probably the most familiar name mm-hmm. in the cast to Americans. And yeah, Miles Davis was on tour in France with a quintet, I believe, at that point. Mm-hmm. And Louis Malle, the director of the film, asked him just to take a look at a rough cut of the film. And then one night they just kind of got together and he and the quintet improvised the score that is probably the greatest score for a film noir ever.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And it's just all the fabulous romance and the kind of doomed romance. Mm-hmm. That's what comes out of that score, right?
Yes.
And it's just marvelous. And that film was a little bit ahead of the French New Wave, right? Mm-hmm. So Louis mm-hmm. Malle doesn't get credit for being part of that with François Truffaut and Jean-Luc Godard and those other guys. But it's a very, very hip film because it's a beautiful crime film that sort of predicts Godard's Breathless with Jean-Paul Belmondo mm-hmm. in some ways, but it's definitely its own thing. And as you know, that score is transportive.
Mm-hmm. It
it's
is
really great.
So then let's talk about, like, you have this wide range of films. Is there something in the lineup that you consider like, this is really obscure and I wish more people knew about this one?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of fitting that we're talking about it on this day because I'm showing a film from Italy called Senza Pietà, Without Pity.
Okay.
And it was made in 1948, and it's such a fascinating, it's a really good film, but also fascinating cultural artifact because the star of the film is an African-American GI
mm-hmm.
who was serving in Italy, who stayed after the war. His name is John Kitzmiller, and he was like an engineering student in the United States who was drafted and served in the war, and both of his parents died when he was serving overseas. Mm-hmm. And so he was a little forlorn and not so eager to return home.
Sure.
And while he was just like hanging around in the officers' club, he was spotted by a guy who worked for Carlo Ponti, the film producer.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked him if he would be in this film that Roberto Rossellini was making, Paisan. And of course it was a significant, important film in the history of Italian neorealism.
Okay.
And then, as it turns out, John Kitzmiller decided to stay in Italy and he started getting lots of acting jobs.
Wow.
And he became a big star in Italy, and he said, you know, this would never have happened to me back home.
Sure.
And it was fascinating. And this film, Without Pity, is a really wonderful noir saga about this GI who forms this really lovely relationship with this Italian working girl.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a romance, sure, but it's so beautifully and subtly done. And then because she's in with underworld types, they decide to use him to steal U.S. ordnance and materiel before it heads back to the States.
Mm.
And he refuses, and
there's the noir.
It becomes a noir thriller at that
yeah.
point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it really is fascinating to see this interracial romance happening in a movie in this time period, in 1948, knowing that this film never would have been made in the United States.
And it didn't get shown in the United States, according to the little synopsis you have.
It played in, you know, major urban markets in the United States. It showed in New York, and it played in Los Angeles. But, you know, it had a extremely limited release.
Sure.
And it, as is usually the case, the American distributors kind of lied when they sold the film. I mean, their advertising approach was to make it really sensational.
Mm.
And, you know, they show Kitzmiller with like a machine gun and this woman's like hanging off his leg, you know, and it's like, and it's really not that kind of a film. It's not like a controversial exploitation film. It's just a film that couldn't have been made in this country
right.
or sold in this country with the subtlety and the discretion that it had when it was shown in Europe.
Got it. Now, I have a question about Elisha Cook Jr. because
Because
growing up, I would see him in the movies, and he always looked like, you know, he was in his 40s, but he was always playing like teenagers. So can you explain, I mean, was he young and just looked really grizzled, or what was his deal?
Well, you know that he was born in San Francisco.
I did not know that.
He was born in San Francisco in 1906.
Okay.
Yeah, so wow. As I like to say, the big quake never ended for Elisha Cook Jr.
Okay.
He was like the most nervous, skitterish guy in films. But yeah, he was a young man in the 1930s. He actually, when you see him in something like Stranger on the Third Floor, which was released in 1940, he actually looks kind of young, but he had that face, you know, that was like, geez, when he was six, he must have looked like he was 26.
Yeah, because you know? As a kid, growing up, whenever I see him, and they call him kid, and I'm like, he looks like he's older than you. I don't understand it, but he really was young.
And the secret to Elijah Cook's on-screen, the trait that he conveyed on screen that was so essential,
mm-hmm.
was that he looked like an older guy, but he seemed very immature.
Mm.
He seemed very callow, I think is the right word.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see him in the Maltese Falcon, where he tries to be a tough guy and stand up to Bogart, he looks to be a little younger than Bogart, but he's like a boy next to Bogart.
Right.
To me, even though he looks older, I mean, it's his behavior. He's trying to convince people that he's a tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing like in Shane, when he gets blasted by Jack Palance in the bar in Shane. I know I'm talking about a Western now, not a noir film, but same thing. He was always like trying to puff himself up to be a tougher guy than he was, which made him seem kind of immature, even though he looked like he was 50 years old.
Yeah, yeah. Because they cast him all the time as the kid, and I just could never wrap my brain around it. Because when you're a kid, everyone looks old, but he always looks particularly old. So
right.
But
right.
But that makes another question, which is, are there cowboy noirs?
Oh, yeah. I get asked this all the time. I have to say, after what is film noir, mm-hmm. it seems like the most common question I get is, so are there other types of noir films? Like, is there a Western noir?
Yeah.
And, you know, the answer to, I say yes. The answer is yes.
Yeah.
But certainly at the time when most of these films were being made, in the late 1940s and early 1950s,
mm-hmm.
As I said, it was a movement.
Sure.
And what I mean by that is there was no economic reason for this to happen. It was the artists themselves were sort of, we want it to look this way now. This is really exciting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just like Cubism or Dadaism or anything like, you know, any art movement, you know, Expressionism, Impressionism.
Mm-hmm.
This was like the noir movement where things shot in black and white primarily, got much darker, edgier. There was a certain look to the cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
And so when all that was just taken out of the city streets and the crime movies of the 1940s and put on the frontier, you know, and on horseback when they're riding horses instead of driving Buicks,
mm-hmm.
they're still photographed the same way.
Okay.
And the stories are very often the same. Like there's a movie called Station West from 1948 that's just like a crime film centered around a nightclub, but it's just like a nightclub in the Old West.
Like a saloon.
Yeah.
Got it.
That's always an interesting question to me because people say, oh no, film noir is about fedoras and Packards and all of this kind of stuff. And I say, well, that's the window dressing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? What the stories are actually about and what the world view is and the artistic perspective of these films is something deeper than the window dressing.
Right.
So when people say, oh, you know, that movie's set in Edwardian England, it's not a noir, I say, so you're telling me that noir is about the clothes.
Right,
because
right,
it's actually about the motivations of the characters and the way you choose to tell the story more than it's about the clothes. So whether they're wearing, you know, top hats or chaps or fedoras, to me, it's all kind of the same.
Yeah, well, that's good because, well, for me, I hate Westerns, love noir. So if there were a noir Western, I think there would be a battle within my head. But I want to also talk about the...
I can give you a whole list. I can give you like 12 of them, Marilyn, if you want to have a weekend of noir Western viewing to see if it changes your mind about
it. I see
Western
a cowboy hat and I completely check out. But talk about, like, I see all of these amazing stills. So talk about the work that went behind, the stills to get the people into the seats.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I love how all these movies were promoted, and there was so much artistry and craftsmanship that went into this stuff, and just the visualization of it. And as a collector of these things, and mm-hmm. I have a pretty vast collection of posters and photographs.
Yeah, you do.
It's really interesting how much effort went into it in this period, in that mid-20th century period.
Mm-hmm.
Because once the 60s rolled around, everything kind of changed. You know, the cameras changed, the visual sensibility changed,
mm-hmm.
and you would see like the photographs that were done by the studios to promote the films became very, very lackluster
mm-hmm.
in the 1960s. It was just like flat, low contrast lighting, nothing. They removed all the Hollywood glamour,
mm-hmm.
and it wasn't just Hollywood that was providing that glamour. I mean, when you see these stills from the movies made in Argentina or Mexico or Italy, they're just as glamorous.
Yes.
You know?
Like I'm looking at the Bitter Rice one. It's like it's perfectly lit with the shadow, you know, like the blurred background. And then you can tell like they use some sort of pin light to get this. Like there's an artistry to it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And Bitter Rice, which we are showing as part of this festival, is sort of a classic example of mixing the neorealist movement that was happening in Italy at that time, where
mm-hmm.
they were trying to deglamorize films,
mm-hmm.
but yet they knew if they wanted the films to be successful internationally, it was probably better to keep a little of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they had some Hollywood stars, you know, like Doris Dowling, who was a Hollywood actress, went there to make that film. Vittorio Gassman would become a star in the United States, even though he's really from Europe in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And Silvina Mignano became a big star at that time, like Gina Lollobrigida and Sophia Loren. You know, these mm-hmm. these very voluptuous, earthy Italian actresses. But
mm-hmm.
but Bitter Rice is the film that put a little patina of glamour on the work of these peasants in the field.
Sure.
And you got like the best of both worlds, right? It was kind of fake,
uh-huh.
but there at least somebody was making a movie that where the women were really the protagonists of this film. And it's a fabulous time capsule of that place and that era.
Yeah, I love all of the black and white photography. But I really like kind of the lurid posters. I have a book of Italian film posters, and
oh my gosh.
like why is her face green? You know, like why? I don't know, but I love it.
No, I know exactly what you're talking about. I mean, I'm quite the disciple of poster art like that,
mm-hmm.
and the Italian posters are extraordinary. And it was interesting because very different from the way American movies were sold, where the studio put its brand on its art.
Mm-hmm.
So 20th Century Fox posters looked a certain way. Warner Brothers posters had a different style. MGM posters adopted a typographic thing. They didn't really care about the art so much as long as you saw a photo of the star.
I never noticed any. I wonder if, like, now that I know that, will it be obvious?
Yeah, you'll notice it once you start seeing it.
Okay.
And after a while, you could just say, oh, that's a Warner Brothers film, just by the style of the art.
That's interesting. You know,
that's all you need.
Okay.
But what's interesting is in Europe, the poster artists were stars in their own right.
Mm.
So in France and Italy, they wanted the poster to be painted by Anselmo Ballester or Alfredo Capitani or something like this, because, like, wow, we want our image done by that person, you know.
Okay.
Same thing in France. There were several pretty famous poster artists. Boris Grissom was one, and Konstantin Belinsky was another one who painted in France. Roger Subi. So, yeah, they're just beautiful, beautiful artwork in its own right, you know. And they let the artists, this is interesting, they let the artists sign the posters, which they did not allow in Hollywood.
Oh.
If you painted the poster in Hollywood, it just belonged to the studio, and you did not get to put your name on it, unless you were Norman Rockwell. He was really the only artist who was commissioned to do movie posters where he got to sign them.
Does that mean that, like, it's lost who did what poster?
Fortunately, there are people who love this stuff enough that they've done the research over the years, and now a lot of these artists are finally getting, you know, their due for being these great artists. There's a fellow named William Rose who painted a lot of posters for RKO. He did the poster for Citizen Kane.
Mm-hmm.
He did a lot of other, I think he did The Best Years of Our Lives and Out of the Past and a lot of things. But you don't see his name on any of the posters.
Okay.
But we now know that he did them. It just requires a dedication on the part of the researchers and the archivists.
Sure,
because
sure.
I think what happened was, back in the day, the studios would produce these things and they'd say, you know, we own it all. It all belongs to us.
Right.
But then 10 or 15 years down the road, the people who start working at the studio are working there because they were inspired by the films. And then they get in the belly of the beast and it's like, now I'm going to find out who actually did this work.
Right.
Whether it's the poster or who actually wrote this screenplay. Because it's often not the person whose name is on the film.
Because of the blacklist?
So, pardon?
Because of the blacklist?
No, I mean, yes, on occasion that's it. But also just because they had contractual agreements. Like, we want to have this person's name on the film because it's prestigious or something.
Right.
But then you learn later, like, they turned in an unusable draft, and somebody who was working at the studio on a salaried basis actually wrote the script.
Wow.
But didn't get the credit.
Or you know, the pay.
Because they were just a studio writer.
Wow. Okay.
So it's interesting that only in subsequent generations has this kind of research been done.
Mm-hmm.
It's entirely because those subsequent generations loved the movies.
Right.
Right, they were
yes.
they were just products when they were being churned out, you know, and they didn't. Nobody got their due credit necessarily, unless you were in the inner circle.
Right.
Now we know a little bit better. We know a little more.
Right. I want to talk before we finish. I want to talk about Strong Room, because the still for that just looks so surreal and stylized. So let's talk about Strong Room for a minute.
Strong Room is another example of one of those completely under-the-radar movies. A friend of mine suggested it to me and gave me kind of a bootleg copy of the film on DVD a few years ago. And it's just so clever. It's a 80-minute British film about these really amateurish crooks who decide to rob a suburban bank. And they do it as the bank is closing on a Saturday. And things go a little sideways, and they end up locking the bank manager and his secretary in the vault when they get startled by the cleaning lady.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm going to give away the whole plot now. But the premise of it is they make off with the money, and these two people are locked in the vault. But then they realize that, like today, it's a bank holiday.
Oh.
And so they're nervous that there isn't going to be enough air in the vault to keep those people alive. So the gang has a existential crisis amongst itself. Like, I agreed to be a bank robber. I didn't sign on to be a murderer.
Right.
So they have to decide whether or not they're going to break back into the bank.
Wow.
People who are trapped. So That's the premise of the movie, and it's quite suspenseful.
Okay. Well, my listening audience, if you haven't figured it out by now, you got to know that Marilyn loves movies. I love silent film. I love noir. I love horror films. Like I love movies. So it's just such a treat to talk with someone who puts on movie festivals and really get to have a day to just talk about all of this stuff. But my listening audience now probably wants to go see all of this stuff. So give us the 411 and how you do it all.
Okay. You go to our website, noircity.com, N-O-I-R-C-I-T-Y, mm-hmm. noircity.com. And you can buy tickets, for either the whole festival. We sell what we call passports mm-hmm. for the whole festival, or you can just buy individual shows. But there will be a link right there that takes you to the ticketing page, and everything is self-explanatory. There's a whole program guide that shows you what we're screening on the website. You know, you can see all of that info. And I'm really looking forward to this because I really think because of my exposure now on Turner Classic Movies, I know that we're drawing not just from the Bay Area, but from a much larger area. There are mm-hmm. people who have this on their calendar every year to, you know, fly in from overseas to see some of these films uh-huh. because, you know, some of these are certainly rare items. And in some cases, even if it's available on Blu-ray or something, it's like, when are you going to have the chance to see it on a big screen in a movie theater?
Yeah.
With a crowd of people. And I'm one of those people who, these days, you know, a lot of people say, I'd just as soon stay home and just watch it, you know, stream it on my TV or whatever. Mm. But I can guarantee you that you're going to have an exciting experience when you come to one of these Noir City festivals, because it's like going to the movies back in, you know, the heyday mm-hmm. of motion pictures, because the hardcore fans who've supported this festival for years, you know, they come out, they dress up. We have cocktails, you know, on occasion during the week, and there's just a great vibe and a real excitement about going to the movies. So it's a special thing, and the Grand Lake is a great theater, and you know, we love showbiz with all the trimmings, you know, with mm-hmm. the spotlight and the curtain goes up and there's an overture and all that. That's what we're all about. So mm-hmm. it's worth leaving home.
And when does the festival start, opening night?
Friday, January 19th.
And how long does it run?
It runs through the following Sunday, January 28th. So I am well aware that there are some football games that are going to be played, you know, in opposition to some of my programming. But, you know, hey, those games only last for 3 hours.
Right.
This festival goes on for 10 days. So you can have everything. You can have your cake and eat it, too.
And for people who never leave San Francisco, where is the theater?
The Grand Lake Theater is right off 580 East. If you take the exit, you'll see the big marquee for the theater, the beautiful marquee mm-hmm. for the Grand Lake right next to the freeway. And, it's very close to Lake Merritt, right across the street from Lake Merritt in Oakland.
And is it easily accessible with public transportation?
Public transportation, I think, would get you to the 19th Street BART station on Broadway, and you may have to take a transfer or just take a lift or something from there.
Okay.
If you're in the East Bay, there are very convenient bus stops right on the street, but if you're coming from outside the area, mm-hmm. probably the 19th Street BART station is the best bet.
Okay. Well, Eddie Muller, again, thank you for giving me all of this time. I tricked you into being my whole guest today. So I really appreciate you being on the show today so that we could talk all about all of these different movies and just film noir in general.
Well, I always have such a fun time talking with you, Marilyn. I regret that I wasn't able to actually get in the studio today, because it's always a pleasure to see you as well as talk to you.
Well, thank you. All right, People of Earth, Noir City 21. You can visit noircity.com, go see movies, go to the Museum of African Diaspora today. Get out there and enjoy. It's just about time for me to turn the mic over to Mr. Ford. It'll be pleasuring your ear holes. So until next week, my friends, ta-ta and toodly-doo.